Welcome to Coming Up for Air, the Allies in Recovery podcast, with hosts Laurie McDougall, Kayla Solomon, and Dominique Simone Levine.
Okay, Kayla, what's our topic for today?
Okay, so our topic is slowing things down. It has a little subtitle, which is, how do you slow things down when you feel like your house is on fire? Because it's like, if you feel like you're dealing with this terrible crisis situation and we're asking you to slow things down, that doesn't really make sense. It feels kind of callous. It feels dangerous. Why are we asking you to do that? So I'm going to let you jump off on whatever that allows you to think.
Yeah. So my first thought right off the bat is, and I have had these thoughts when I was early in my journey, stop and slow it down. It was like, what the hell are you telling me? What? Like, he's going out the door right now. He's probably going to die. He's going to die. And I can't slow it down. I can't. I cannot. In fact, I got to speed it up because I got to find some way to convince him or her not to even walk out that door.
Right. That's the first responder piece of it, which is, here it is. There's an impending horrible situation, impending doom, an emergency that's happening right in front of my eyes, which if you think about what you just said, my person is walking out the door and that's the emergency. Why are we even talking about slowing down? So let me talk a little bit about slowing down first, because, you know, for people who might be listening for the first time, when we talk about slowing down, what we mean is that a lot of what our interactions are with people that we love who have difficult behavior is reactive. There's something that's said, and we say or do something without thinking, without stopping to process our thoughts or our feelings, and we just say something or do something. And what we're really talking about here, which is, I think, personally for myself, the hardest thing in the world, is to come up with another way to pause or stop before you do anything. And as somebody in our group said, you have to learn the value of not doing. You have to learn that not doing something is an actual behavior. It's an actual choice. It's an actual action. Not doing is an action.
And not doing is actually possibly doing something differently. If you are reacting all of the time, when you stop reacting, you're doing something differently. And that person, that individual, is going to be a little confused because that's not your typical reaction.
Exactly. And so what you just said, which I love, is the confusion part. Because you're like, oh, the person's going to be confused. Is that a good thing? Yes. Because what all of CRAFT is about, what the whole AlliesInRecovery.net program is about, is change. It's about doing things differently. And you have, all of us, when we have relationships with people, we wind up having patterns of behavior, things that we do, and we actually become exceptionally predictable. That person does this or is possibly going to do this, and I know I'm going to say this or do this thing. And so it's this little dance that you do. Everybody knows the steps. You're going to say, where are you going? What are you doing? You know, what's happening? They're going to say, I'm not talking to you, and they leave. And then you go through whatever you always do when they leave. And so what we're saying is, let's try something different. Let's tweak something and shift in just even a very tiny way, and then see what the impact is on the other person.
The other interesting piece about this is you do want to see what happens with the other person, but also doing this, pressing pause and slowing things down, doesn't mean they're not going to walk out the door 10 minutes later and go and use. But reframing it in your mind as, yep, they might go and do that, but they didn't for that this couple of minutes because things are changing. And the other thing is they weren't going to before when, you know, you're at them and you're trying to convince them, or, you know, you're upset and you're reacting to the situation. They were already headed out to go and do whatever it is that they were going to do. So understanding that you're slowing it down and you are reducing something over the next short period of time.
You talk about this all the time, is short-term versus long-term. And I'm hesitant to say this, but in order to really do this work, we have to keep big picture in our heads here. And that is very hard to do when we feel like there's impending doom happening in the next half hour. But actually, it's the only thing that has a shot at working. Because this is also the definition of insanity, which is you've been doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results. And what we're saying is, in order to not do the same thing over and over and over again, something has to shift, and you start with the pause.
I do talk about short-term and long-term a lot, but understanding the relationship between short-term and long-term is a really, really important piece. And so actually what you're doing in the short-term by begging and pleading and trying to convince is not resulting in a positive long-term result. So if you change that short-term piece of it, it has to ultimately change the long-term piece of it as well. And even if in the moment when you're first trying to kind of press pause here and slow things down, the one thing you get to change is the amount of time, even if it's just 3 minutes before they actually do walk out the door. It's 3 minutes less than it would have been if you had been chasing them down and running to the car or crying. And it's also another way to think about it is, it's also less time of driving them to go and do something. Because when we react in kind of a demanding or a pleading kind of way, people tend to turn away from us. They're more likely to go out and do their thing. Versus you slow it down and you're not responding, they are more likely to stay there and linger for a little bit longer.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it reminds me of this 12-step saying, which is they're doing it at you. So basically it's like, if you have been pushy and obnoxious and pleading and begging and sad and crying and the things that we do, everybody knows what the thing that they do, nagging, then what happens is, I've heard so many times on the other end with the person who's using, that they're drinking or drugging at this person. So part of it is like, well, screw you, I'm going to use. And then they make you the excuse for why they did it. And we've all heard that. I'm doing this because of you. And so the stepping back and the pausing and the waiting and changing the dynamic is to try to take yourself out of that equation. So when they are using, it's because they want to use. You didn't say anything terrible. You weren't pushy. You're just saying, hey, how's your day? You know, whatever. And then they leave and you might have the same exact feelings, but you haven't created the same dance. So you take yourself out of there. This is why I'm using. It's because of you that I'm using. You stress me out.
Yeah, you're taking new steps in the dance.
Right.
You're not continuing the dance that everybody knows so well. You're changing up the steps. There's also another piece of this that I think is really, really important to talk about, and that is perception, because oftentimes we as the family member or friend that loves this person so much perceives a situation as a crisis. So you talked about, you know, oh, the house is on fire, when actually it's not, it's chronic. A crisis is when, you know, someone's bleeding out. It's a really extreme situation. And I know it sounds extreme. Your loved one's going to go out and use, I don't know, they're going to go use, you know, fentanyl, and you're freaking out. How is this not a crisis? Well, it's not a crisis. It's chronic. They keep going out. They keep doing it. You keep chronically responding the same way. And if you can step back and pause it and rethink it, reframe it in your own mind, that actually this is chronic. This is something that keeps happening, and it's going to continue to happen if everything stays the same. So what I need to do is I need to slow it down a little bit and do some thinking and bring the best me to the table. So change my role in what's happening.
Now, listen to what you're saying, because this goes back to some of the modules where we talk about positive self-talk. We talk about shifting how you're thinking. We talk about first thought, second thought, which basically is your first thought is, oh my God, they're going to go die. They're going to go shoot up and die. So that goes to the crisis. Oh my God, I have to go and save them, put my cape on, go flying out, make sure that they don't take anything so they're not dead. And you could see how, you know, if it happened one time, they're going out to shoot up for the first time and you can stop it, that's great. But this is happening all the time. And so Does that put you in a position to have to run behind them every day, make sure they don't do that? It actually is not a reasonable possibility for you to behave in that way. It doesn't work. And so what you just described is you're changing the story in your head, okay, which is, you know, I have no idea actually what they're doing, even if they are using, and I have to calm my system down, and I'm working on me. The only thing I could do right now is work on me. And how do I change how I'm thinking about this? How do I, you know, use not doing something as an action? And maybe that works differently. Maybe I'm changing something. How do I do tiny different things all the time so that in the long term, I'm changing this relationship? And maybe that's going to keep the person safe or be have them more interested in going into treatment. So you're basically changing the story in your head, because the story for me when I'm in the house is on fire is, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, something terrible is going to happen. And it is my personal responsibility to prevent it. And believe me, I have that hero complex. And so I have done that so many times. And what's fascinating to me is it's a repellent to everybody in my life. Literally, it is a repellent. It's like when I am stepping forward, trying to prevent things, trying to anticipate all the details about what could go wrong, every single person in my life feels like I'm overstepping. I'm telling them that they are incompetent. I'm doing it for them, and they are so mad at me. And so it starts from a place of everybody's offended by me, and then that I have absolutely no power in that situation because people are just mad at me.
Which doesn't minimize, for family members, it really is trauma to them.
Yes.
It is trauma that's happening to you because it is a perception of a crisis, right? I mean, I've been there every time he stepped out the door. I believed it to my core that he was going to die. And that's a reality in this world, right? There is a strong possibility of that happening. And so it's really hard to convince somebody when they're in that state and you're in really, you're in a state of trauma. You know, the caveman brain has kicked in. This is really dangerous. And I have to do absolutely everything in my power to change it. The problem is it's very difficult to see what you have control over and what you don't have control over. And then once you do realize what you don't have control over, you get really pissed off and frustrated because you don't have control over it. And that can cloud your judgment too. That can cloud things and make things more complicated. I don't want anyone to, any of our listeners to think that we're not empathetic. We are incredibly empathetic to the family member. It is an unbelievably emotional, oftentimes paralyzing interaction and experience when you're perceiving this as this is a crisis and I have to do something. But if you can just slow it down, even if you just slow it down for 30 seconds, and then the next time, 45 seconds, and then the next time, a minute, just take it baby steps by baby steps. And actually, in that quiet space, in that slowing down of the space, that is a time to turn inward and check in with yourself. Because if you can calm yourself down, you're actually more likely to be able to come up with the words that you want to use that are more compassionate and maybe empathetic and understanding. You're more likely to come up with a plan that is going to impact and influence your loved one in a particular, more positive direction. And also, I watched something, oh gosh, I don't even know where I think it was a TED Talk. I have to look it up. But there's actually a time frame when you're in a panic like that, when your brain is sensing danger and just you're in a crisis kind of mode, that your brain is all jumbled up and that they say that is the absolute worst time to be trying to make decisions. You almost can't. So that's another reason why you want to slow it down and get yourself into a better headspace, because you will be better at dealing and coping with these kind of interactions.
And remember that there's cortisol. So the enzyme in your system that's actually the stress hormone is cortisol, which is why we carry belly fat, which is why we actually feel like we have corrosive, you know, corrosive you know, like toxins in our system, because there's actually enzymes flowing through our system that are actually caustic and harmful. And so the more you can calm that down, the more healthy you're going to be physically, physiologically. And we need you to be healthy to do this. So think about that. It's like your health actually is of consequence here. It matters. It's so funny that when you're in the crisis mode, that feels like a luxury. Oh, taking care of myself, feeling good, doing what I need to do, that feels like there's no time. But if you think about that, one of the pillars of this program is self-care, calming your system down, self-soothing, changing how you think about things and how you talk to yourself in your head. That actually changes so much about your life. And when you drop the anxiety, by the way, I use the word repellent, a calm person, a person who's like not looking at you, that you're going to, you know, die the next moment, is actually attractive. And so that's the side effect of what we're asking you to do, is to become more attractive to the other person. They might not be, you know, chasing you down, but they're more likely to be with you if you're not exuding anxiety and concern and nagging.
I love that point. I think that's a great point. And everybody, all of our listeners, if you can just stop for a moment and think about this, think about your mother. Just think about your mother. Do you want a mother that's calm and sits and listens to you, holds to healthy boundaries and is assertive and firm, but she listens? Or do you want a mother that screams and punishes you and tells you how horrible a child you are? And which mother are you more attracted to? So think about it that way. And that's true in all relationships, a boss and an employee, romantic relationships, brothers and sisters, friends, all relationships. Who are you attracted to? The people that hear you, the people that listen, or the people that tell you what an awful person you are, or, you know, or yell at you or plead with you to do what they're telling you to do? Or so think about that. Really, really sit down and think about that.
No, and I just, there's this other factor, which is that you want to create a relationship that you actually can feel calm with, which means that you have to think about this differently. That when you look at your loved one, you're not in the panic mode when you look at them, that you're looking at them. And it's funny, because this is what I've been doing, is I'm looking at what they are competent at, what I do like about them, what I'm grateful for, the good things. Now, sometimes you're going to be digging really deep to get that piece of information if somebody's been doing bad behavior for a while. But your job is to find something good about them, because they've lost track of that. And if you could see that, and that's the kind of place that you're reaching them, that there's all these people in our groups that talk about, okay, I had to sit down and figure out what the person I cared about was interested in. So do I want to watch NASCAR? No, I do not. But I do, because that matters. Do I want to like listen to hip hop? No, but my kid does. So I'm interested. My partner's into bicycles. I'm trying to learn more about that and be interested. That's when you're reaching your loved one for who they are and what they're interested in. And so if I'm trying to figure out my possibilities of what I can talk about, that's an excellent distraction from me, that from you are going to behave badly, something terrible is going to happen, I have to save you. It's more like, okay, I saw this show and I think that you would really like that show. Maybe we could watch that. Or, you know, like with my kid, I have to talk about TJ Maxx. That's her love language, is shopping. I hate shopping, but when I hang out with her, I will go shopping, because that's our connection. And so it's that kind of stuff. It's like you push yourself to a place that you wouldn't necessarily go to meet them. And then that feels like connection to them. So it's not what feels like connection to you. It's what feels like connection to them. And that's what you're working on. So it's an incredible way to refocus your thoughts and actually do something.
And it's a benefit if you can find something that you both enjoy doing.
Well, I do find a few good things at TJ Maxx.
There you go. There you go. You know, also one other thing I want to kind of add in here, because I hear this over and over from family members, that they feel selfish when they are taking care of themselves. I hope our listeners can kind of reframe this thought in your mind and start training yourself to kind of think of it differently. It's probably one of the most unselfish things you can do, because you're doing it for the other people in your life. Because when you bring to the table a healthy you, it affects everybody else. You know, of course, I'm not going to be able to talk people out of how they're feeling. If you feel selfish because you feel like, oh, it's so selfish of me to stop and check in with myself and engage in some form of self-care, try reframing it and say, but if I do this, I'm going to bring a healthier me to the table, and I'm going to be able to more effectively influence and change this situation in a more positive direction, which is all the more reason for you to be taking care of yourself.
And this is a really important point, because part of what the dynamic that you're trying to change is that person feels guilty about what they've done to you. You think that they don't care. You think that they're just doing this to you and they're trying to hurt you. But really what's happening is that this cycle has happened and they can see how much harm their behavior is causing you. And what you're doing is stepping back and allowing them to have their own process and not be the, oh, I can't believe you could do this to me. Because if you start taking care of yourself, that actually gives the other person space to not have to go into that guilt and shame and blame and actually possibly start doing the same thing for themselves. It's like you take that like icky, gluey, you know, we're kind of merged together in this dance, and you separate it so that they start to have different steps in their dance as well, if they're not doing it in reaction to you. It's huge. It's huge. But also it's like you become, I'm going back to the attractive word, you become more attractive when you're self-contained and you're not blaming and you're not looking to the other person for your well-being and you're actually taking time. It's attractive.
You know, as family members, we spend so much time saying, well, they're blaming me. They're saying, you know, it's my fault. It's this, it's that. But we end up doing the same thing back at them, right? Don't do this. How can you? You're killing your father, right? Your father's going to have a heart attack. I can't believe you're doing this to us. And, you know, no, it's you. It's your behavior. It's the same thing. And so if we want our loved ones to learn to be accountable for their own behavior, and we want them to learn to, I don't know, have some form of an apology towards us or to just be respectful, it starts with us changing. It starts with us understanding that our feelings are not their burden. Not saying that they don't affect how we feel, but the soothing of our feelings is our responsibility. And when you pause like that, they're left with, oh, she's not yelling. Oh, I got to face what I just did and I got to think about it. At least, at the very least, if you can just do it in very tiny little baby steps, just get yourself started and just slowly, slowly back away from this big reaction out of panic, fear, and love, because that's what it is. It's panic, it's terrifying, but it's also deep love and self-protection, because you also don't want to go through the horrific thing that might happen on the other side of it. But if you can just start with these small, small little baby steps and move in that direction, I think you'll be surprised at how effective it can be.
So really what we're talking about is you making a decision to be an agent of change by changing yourself. That's what this is. That's the summary of the whole thing. It's like, what are you doing that's not working? How do you step back? How do you take space? How do you change the dance? And you cannot do that if you're moving too fast and you're not assessing what you're doing and you're not thinking. That's what this is. So this whole podcast is about being an agent of change. But change starts slowly. I was talking to somebody the other day and they're trying to start exercising after an accident. And so they could do 5 minutes. And their personal trainer said, you do the 5 minutes and then every day you add another 10 seconds. 10 seconds. You could do anything for 10 seconds. That's what we're talking about. Microscopic changes to start, and then it accumulates. And that's all we're doing, is accumulating the change.
And we're talking about microscopic change in very intense perceived moments of crisis.
Which is all the time.
Yeah, like I said, every time he stepped out the door.
If crisis happens all the time, it's no longer a crisis, it's chronic. So just remember that you cannot have the same behavior if it's chronic behavior, because it's unsustainable. You can't run up a hill, or you can't like lift a car off of somebody every day. That's a crisis. You really have to slow it down and figure out how you're going to change the dynamic in the long run.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Have a great week.
Yep. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks for listening. We hope this episode of Coming Up for Air spoke to you. If you're listening in today on a podcast platform that isn't the Allies member site, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating. This helps others find the show more easily. If you have a suggestion for a new topic or a guest for the show, please reach out through the Contact Us form on alliesinrecovery.net. Special thanks to our hosts, our guests, and our production team.